Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep and we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, a TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Today, we're looking at the social history of food in Britain. It's something I've been fascinated by my entire life, ever since I discovered that my friends weren't supposed to know that we ate margarine and not butter at home. And when my mum insisted, I keep my elbows off the table, but she couldn't give me a good reason why. Of all the aspects of life governed by unfathomable rules, food and eating is probably more hidebound than any other. Society and food have been inextricably linked. But what does this mean today? How much does the food industry recognise and perpetuate these social differences? And in a time of food poverty and food banks, can we overcome prejudices and improve people's diets? We're looking for clues in history, and with me is historian Pen Vogler. You might know Pen from her fantastic books. She's the author of Scoff, Dinner with Mr. Darcy, and Dinner with Dickens. Or maybe you've seen her recreating historical recipes for museum exhibitions or on the TV. Welcome, Pen. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Right, let's get started. Let's go into the deep end. Is the social history of food bound up in concepts of class, or is that simplistic? Is it more about access to food?
Everything in Britain is bound up with concepts of class. and with food particularly, I think, and it's not just food, it's everything around it. It's that you mentioned in the introduction, it's what we'd call the material culture. So your knives, your forks, your napkins, serviettes, whatever you call them, the times of day that you eat, the language you use around food, and then, of course, what you have on your plate, you know, whether you have roast grouse and game chips or, you know, porridge or whatever, says a lot about where you come from or what you aspire to. And I think it's because for centuries we started off in 10, I'm not going to blame everything on the French, but 1066 the Normans come in
and, but you're going to anyway, I like it.
And then suddenly there's two massive tiers. There's the upper class, the Norman tier, and then there's kind of the Anglo-Saxon who get kind of relegated to peasant status mostly. And then you start having kind of two different cuisines. You have the French one, and for centuries the French cuisine has been the thing that we kind of locate as the posh one, you know, the upper class. And that's changed a bit, that's got a bit more complex. But we seem very comfortable, weirdly comfortable, with this idea in Britain that you have a two-tier system. We have good food for people who have the access to it and the education and the wealth. And then everybody else has kind of what is kind of pushed out, what is rolled out. And at the moment, that is sort of ultra high processed fast food or cheap food, essentially. And I think the fact that we think that that's kind of inevitable comes from our kind of long history of kind of a kind of class divisions. So that's jumping right in at the deep end.
No, I think, well, that's perfect, though. And I'm interested, though, because I've striven my entire life to try and deny class and to sort of say, well, it doesn't mean anything to me. You know, my family has shifted so much, you know, in just one, you know, one generation. And so I'm wondering, jumping ahead to probably to the end of our discussion as well, is does class still exist in an important sense right now, or has it been superseded in importance? I mean, obviously it does exist, but has it been superseded in importance by simpler ideas like wealth and poverty, or are they now one and the same?
Yeah, that's the kind of key question, really, isn't it? And I mean, we still use that kind of Victorian taxonomy of class, don't we? Kind of upper, middle, lower. And we kind of basically think, you know, if you're upper class, you live off your capital. If you're middle class, you have a, you know, a salary. And if you're lower class, in inverted commas, you have a wage. And for kind of convenience, that's still quite useful. A lot of young people have said to me what you have just said. You know, they said, you know, class, that's a problem of our parents' generation. It doesn't matter to us. And I think what is replacing class at the moment is what those lovely French theoretical sort of anthropologists and sociologists, people like Pierre Bourdieu, would have called cultural capital. And so young people have cultural capital, which means that they are very confident about saying, oh, I'm going to eat granola and a burger, you know. And I'm going to eat my salad with my fingers, in a restaurant because I feel confident in doing that. In the same way they might say, you know, I listen to hip hop and I go to the opera. Mm. It's partly to do with wealth, but it's also partly to be doing the kind of feeling that the choices that you make are the right choices because you make them. And that's a lot to do with confidence, and that's a lot to do with kind of cultural background.
Yeah.
And so the idea that specific foods or specific way of eating, like you're saying, you know, your elbows on the table, doesn't necessarily kind of belong to kind of one class now, but the idea that you can sort of navigate a social situation because of your kind of background, that's still with us. We just see it in a different way.
Yeah. Can you boil down class to that classic Dr. Seuss story, the Sneetches, I think it's called, which is basically about, there was a bunch of Sneetches, which were creatures that lived on an island, I think, and some of them had stars on them and some of them didn't. And the ones that had stars on were the upper class, and they had everything. Everyone wanted to be them, mm. until some bloke came along with a star making machine, and so everyone could have stars. So then the people that had the stars weren't special anymore, so they took off their stars, so then they were still special again, and he kept on switching them around. I mean, I guess the question really is class ever a positive and useful thing, or is it something insidious? I mean, you know, my fury about class has kind of driven me throughout my entire life, but are there places and times where it has been useful and positive?
In the food situation, well, one of the things I think that we're very good at in this country is absorbing new ideas and, you know, taking on kind of new food, different food cultures and, you know, different kind of ethnic foods and all the rest of it, ethnic diets. You know, people say British cuisine is a kind of melting pot. And that comes, I think, not specifically from class, but from our kind of fluidity. So we are a kind of fairly class-bound nation. And yet, because of our kind of history, because of the history of, you know, kind of industrialization, people getting wealthy that weren't sort of in a kind of traditional sort of aristocracy, we have become much more used to the idea of class being a kind of fluid thing, that people kind of being able to kind of go up and go down class. And so I think for that reason, it's made us more adventurous, more absorptive. But it brings along its own problems, you know, of course, because you have the class system. But it does mean that so the downside is that at the moment, like I say, we have this kind of like this two-tier system and this sense that, you know, people with kind of one social background can access one kind of food and everybody else has to just have whatever's cheap. But it does mean that we've absorbed more ideas, I think, from other people.
Yeah. Okay, why don't we go through a few different elements that bind society and food together. Do you want to give us some examples of the differences that are denoted by the relationship that we have with food? Is it about language? Is it about the actual foodstuffs themselves, the stuff that surrounds it? What do you think of the things that really started the difference? Was it you know, in medieval times where people would eat their food off trenches and then hand their sodden trencher to the peasants? Or is it something a bit deeper? Is it about difference?
Well, I think all those things are a little kind of network, aren't they? So the food you eat, the language you use, the time you have your meal, you know, if you call it a meal.
Well, tell us a little bit more about the times, because that's really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, so the times are really interesting because that has changed enormously in the last few hundred years. So this whole thing about lunch and dinner and tea, you know, that is, to be honest, this thing that people are most interested in when I talk about class, because everybody can see that. They can see that if they come from the north or come from a particular background, they might call the thing they have in the middle of the day dinner and the thing they have at the end of the day tea. And if you come from a sort of a middle class background in, I don't know, London or Salisbury or something, you might say, no, the thing we have in the middle of the day is lunch, and then I have dinner or supper at the end of the day. And
what's posher? Is dinner posher or supper is supper posher? I've never been able to work that one out.
At the moment, supper is probably posher.
Supper's posh, isn't it? Okay.
Yeah, because dinner went through a kind of a rocky period when people started having dinner parties and dinner parties on television And then everybody thought, gosh, you know, if you could have a dinner party on television, you can have come dine with me. That means the dinner party isn't very, you know, it's suddenly demotic and suddenly we don't want to have anything to do with it. And so we're going to have supper. And if you have a butler to serve your supper, even better. So, yeah, the language is really important. And then historically, but it's changed enormously. So if you look at Shakespeare, they would have their dinner at kind of maybe 10 or 11 o'clock. Pepys was having his dinner at 12 o'clock in the middle of the day, and then they would have supper later. And I think what happened is that as this kind of middle, we talked about earlier, this kind of middle class grew through kind of industrialization, through people in trade, through people making money, they started to have their dinner later and later in the day to kind of distinguish themselves from the workers who needed some fuel in the middle of the day. Yeah. And so by Jane Austen's time, she's talking about having dinner at 3 p.m. And she says to her sister, you know, that's quite unsophisticated. It's quite rural. You'll despise us because if you're in the town and being sophisticated, you'll be having your dinner at 5 or 6 o'clock. Yeah. And then it gets later and later. And it's a lot to do with kind of a class sort of moving, trying to put some clear blue water between them and the people that they consider to be below them. And the time of day is an easy kind of way of doing that.
And do you think that still exists? Is there still a concept, not about the language, but the timing? So I struggle to feed my family before 9 currently.
Oh my
God, terrible.
It's very posh.
It's really naughty. And so does that mean I'm poor? Well, it's just, I mean, literally, I've been working and then I want to make some food and the kids are going, come on, Dad. But is there still this time shift between different sort of places and different classes in the UK?
There is to a degree. I think there's this concept that eating slightly earlier and calling it tea, particularly, you know, which is quite, I grew up in Yorkshire. That was quite, you know, that's what all my friends did.
Yeah.
You'd have your tea at 5 or 6 o'clock. And that comes from the idea that you'd have a cup of tea with your tea.
Yeah.
And if you were a mill family, you know, if you were kind of an industrial family or even a kind of hard, you know, or even a hardworking agricultural family in the 19th century, when tea had become cheaper, you would have that cup of tea just to turn a kind of rather boring cold bread and cheese meal into a hot meal with a bit of kind of lift.
Yeah.
And I think that's why that word became so important to us. But I think it still exists. And for a lot of people, are struggling to have a meal as a family at all. So to a degree, that is almost a class thing, because to have the time, the table, the chairs, the space, the wealth,
absolutely,
to get the whole family around the table and not be working shift work and all the rest of it, that says something about your income and your background.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, I'm just an idiot. That's the reason I eat late. It's not because I'm posh at all. Okay, let's talk a little bit about manners. Now, manners have fascinated me for years. I hate manners. I accept that things are useful in society, but I always see them as something negative rather than positive. Am I wrong?
I would say there's a difference between manners and etiquette. And I think, so etiquette grew up as a sort of started off as a sort of system of manners, and some of them are quite useful. So things like, for example, do not put some bones back in the communal plate when once you've eaten them.
Yeah.
Don't blow your nose on the tablecloth. You know, don't bring your knife to the table. And if you think about, and this is an etiquette for a kind of one of those big sort of houses where you might, you know, in Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall, there's this description of Cromwell's house where he has lots and lots of young men who he's training to be part of the kind of court and part of the kind of, aristocratic system. And you can imagine all those young men there, all their kind of testosterone, all kind of wanting to kind of possibly fight each other and getting a bit testy. And so those manners were actually incredibly important, you know, to teach them.
So that was actually about safety, about actually sort of getting people to work together.
Getting people to work together and not grossing them out.
Yeah. I accept that. That bit of manners I'm happy with. You know, I never wanted to upset my mum.
I think we're happy with it because we've had centuries where it has kind of, you know, we now just think, yes, of course, I'm not going to pick my teeth at the table, although some people do. So those things. And then the thing I think that we're probably talking about is the net of etiquette that kind of grew up around Victorian times. So again, it goes back to this time when there was a real speedy kind of changeover of power and wealth in industrialising England. Yeah. And the people at the top said, we've got to keep these kind of, you know, these industrialists out of our social circle, and we're going to do it. And obviously it's not, they didn't sit around and have a meeting, but it was a sort of part of the system. We're going to do it by kind of inventing rules that are quite difficult to pick up. You need to kind of be, you know, about how you eat your jelly with a fork.
So nuanced.
You know, and whether the fact that you'd hide your bread roll in the napkin to your left. So if you don't know those rules and you shake your napkin out, your bread roll is going to kind of go flying and hit your neighbour's head or something, you know. And just things about how to carve, you know, elegantly without kind of splatting everybody with the gravy and stuff. And so it was kind of invented as this kind of network of rules, and they changed really fast. And the idea was that they kept out the people at the bottom. Well, the people at the bottom had to kind of learn them in order to be admitted to something up at the top. And so we still have some of those rules. So I think manners, I would distinguish between manners which are to do with making the people you're eating with feel comfortable.
And but then you're drawn in by, you know, that saying, well, I don't want to upset somebody, means that you're complicit, you're drawn into these things, that, and so suddenly something that seemed like a good idea, I just don't want to upset anyone, means that you're strengthening what's already there. It's a dangerous place, isn't
yeah. Well, I think there's a nuance, and there's you know, this idea that, you know, this is whole thing about the gravy boat, isn't it? If you spill the gravy boat, good manners means not noticing. Not making a big thing about it if somebody else spills a gravy boat.
Yeah, if you fart at the table, just nobody should actually mention it, and that's good manners. It's
you don't make somebody feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
At the kind of the supper table or the dinner table or something. Whereas etiquette is about keeping people out.
Okay. Here's, now, this one thing that's always fascinated me. Sorry, it's all about me. It's not about you. one thing that's fascinated me is this idea that kids shouldn't play with their food. Now, I've done a huge amount of work on trying to get kids to eat better.
Yeah.
And I realised that I was telling my kids when they were tiny, stop playing with your food. Stop mucking about with it. Stop mixing it around. You know, stop mixing the gravy with the ice cream. It's disgusting. And I suddenly stopped myself at one point and thought, what am I doing? Why not do that? What's wrong? Why am I to say that gravy and ice cream doesn't go together? That's your. I don't want you to waste food. I don't want you to throw it around. But why shouldn't you play with your food? Why shouldn't you enjoy it? Why shouldn't you own your own food? And I wonder if part of our kids' pretty awful diets, or, you know, our problems with our nutritional problems in the UK, are to do with a set of rules that we build around food. What do you think? Am I clutching at straws there?
I mean, are you talking about kind of children's diets specifically?
Absolutely, yeah. So I worried. I suddenly thought that, okay, am I building up a barrier between kids and food? And then they start saying, well, I'm not going to eat that. And I sort of a place of conflict rather than a place of love when you sit at the table. And I just worried about that, but I could never come to a conclusion as to whether that was true or my fulminating.
I mean, I am absolutely no expert on, you know, how to feed children. So I can only kind of think about it within a kind of framework of kind of social history. I think the fact that kids play with food in a way is great, because it means they feel confident that there is food there and it's going to come. And if you look at most people in history before about 1900, they probably would have just eaten anything that they could get, because most people were poor, and along with that poverty came a lack of food. And so, I mean, there was a tradition, if you look at kind of records of agricultural workers, for example, and what they eat throughout, and the recording started in about the late 18th century, people suddenly started saying, do you know something, instead of saying this is what happens, why don't we go and look at what happens? It was a kind of absolute innovation. And you got all these self-appointed scholars, but they were kind of interesting, who were doing data collection for the first time. And most of them show that most workers' diets are really very poor. They have It's basically bread, some kind of grain, and some cheese and some bacon. And then it sort of changes, you know, they get more sugar and more tea and things as it gets later. But the man's diet would be better. And if there was some protein and some meat, he would have it, and the kids and the wife would go without. And so bringing up children to be well-educated or to be kind of healthy with that kind of poor diet was almost impossible. And there's this very famous statistic in the Boer War that people realised that working class recruits were 5 inches shorter than privately educated recruits. And that's because of diet. So in a context, the fact that your kids are playing with food is great. They have it. That doesn't help you.
Absolutely. Have it at all.
Yeah, that doesn't absolutely help you at all. But I do think there's something about our changing view of childhood that comes from this background. And I do think there's something about how, so sugar, for example, I mean, sugar used to be incredibly expensive. It was kind of used as a spice, imported in very small quantities. And then slowly starts to be used as a kind of bribe for children. It starts to be used as the thing that you give children. And we're talking about probably the mid-18th century, that you give kids, you know, some marmalade or comfits or whatever. And I think that was a historical kind of trajectory that's not necessarily inevitable. We didn't have to use sugar as a way of bribing children. We could have used fruit or something, but we were pretty anti-fruit. We thought fruit gave you, you know, diarrhea or something. And so fresh fruit and it also obviously wasn't as available. Yeah. So I do think there is a place where we've probably slightly gone wrong with this idea that children have special food and it is designed to kind of, you know, like children's cereal, you know, with huge amounts of sugar in it. It's designed just to make them eat rather than designed to make them healthy.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you've mentioned industrialization as a sort of a point at which food and society fundamentally changed. Tell us a little bit more about that. How's this reflected in food?
It depends how far back you go. I mean, I think, you know, obviously Britain was the first country in the world to industrialize. And it did it quite brutally by cutting people off from their access to the land through the enclosures. And creating a class of kind of working people who suddenly had to go from being semi-self-sufficient to being in a wage economy. And it's really interesting because if you talk to anybody, not anybody, but lots of people in Europe, for example, you know, they still, particularly Eastern Europe, I think, they still kind of assume that they're going to kind of, they might keep chickens and ducks, and they assume that they're going to kind of grow their own vegetables and that's just what you do. Whereas if you notice here on Mumsnet, for example, Mumsnet say that the most middle class thing at the moment is growing your own vegetables. And that
oh, how things have changed.
Crazy. But that, yeah, I think, comes from this idea in the 18th, 19th century that we're going to kind of create this working wage population, take them off the land. And, you know, they become the people who are working in industrialization, in the industries, and then they have to be fed, and they have to be fed as cheaply as possible, because industrialists don't want to feed them too much. I sound like a Marxist, but you know, I think it's kind of there in the record, isn't it?
Sound like a realist to me, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And that's when we start importing food. So we start saying, actually, you know, we can't produce food cheaply enough to feed all these workers. We need to import grain and meat and cheese when you get refrigeration. And so from about 1845, we started just, our imports went up and up and up to enable us to be an industrial economy. And I think kind of that kind of concept that kind of industry sort of is the solution comes into our food as well. You get the Chorley Wood process where bread gets made very fast, very quickly with a lot of yeast and all the rest of it. And everything has to be done cheaply and quickly. I think industrialization comes from a sort of this kind of national mindset.
And you mentioned imports, and we started importing food there. And I guess the nature of those imports are important as well to society. I mean, is it a question of certain foods like coffee and spices and things like that and sugar, I guess? Does that denote class? Does that keep people apart in some way to begin with?
It's really interesting because this is what I found in my writing my book, that every food has its own little story. It has its own little trajectory, and it's quite hard to kind of say, this is what happens. So on the whole, there's this idea that things come into the aristocracy. So tea, for example, or coffee or whatever, it comes into an upper class and then kind of filters down. And that's not actually necessarily the case with everything. So tea, for example, came into and was mostly sort of spread through our clubs in kind of 18th century London, and people went to go and drink tea and coffee in them and talk about kind of politics or business or whatever it was that they were interested in. And that seems like a kind of a much more kind of middle class thing, which brings it in. And then if you look at other things, so for example, potatoes, chili, anything from the Columbian Exchange, so things that came from what was then the New World, potatoes and chili, they all have their own trajectories. So potatoes and tomatoes spend a long time out in the kind of social wilderness before people will accept them as food, even, you know, as even edible. People think that they will give you terrible leprosy or something, literally, in the case of potatoes.
Yeah. Well, they had the early ones were quite bitter, weren't they? They had lots of solanine in them, so they had a bitterness. So you can sort of get it, but then as people grew various different varieties, it ended up becoming such an important crop that it became too important, and we had the Irish potato famine. And there are these cycles as well, which aren't necessarily a good thing.
I mean, monoculture is never a good thing. I mean, you know, is it? I mean, I think. We haven't talked about the avocado yet, but I'm sure we will.
Come on, let's go. Okay, get into the avocado. Come on.
But, you know, this idea that we have nearly whatever it is, 80 or 90% of avocados grown in the world are kind of one type, cannot be a good thing, because I don't know anything about kind of avocado growing, but if you had the equivalent of the Irish potato blight, then what, you know? And I think the problem of... the potato famine was that the Irish were growing one particular variety called the lumper, and it was particularly prone to the blight. And we got the blight here. I mean, you know, a lot of working class people were very dependent on potatoes in Britain as well. They weren't so dependent. They had grain as well. They were more different types. And that might, I don't know this for certain, I'm quite interested, but that might have helped to kind of alleviate the blight here, because it wasn't as bad in Britain as it was in Ireland.
Yeah, yeah. And we also have the banana, so we now cultivate pretty much only the Cavendish banana.
Yeah.
Again, which is beginning to, you know, we're beginning to see problems with that, and because we don't have enough variety, then that could be really problematic. So now, what do you think is driving our tastes today and our changing tastes? Are we still bound by class? I would say that that people don't look to royalty anymore, or royalties are quite a small section of people, but you know, the aristocracy, they're no longer tastemakers. So how has this changed, and how would you now define what drives the kind of the differences in how people eat?
What we have is a structure where we have this kind of class structure. And so when you have the people at the top might change. So it's not royalty. We don't particularly care we're quite interested actually in what the Queen eats. But
there's quite a few TV series about things like that.
We don't particularly care. But we do care, you know, what tastemakers eat. We care what Gwyneth Paltrow eats, or, you know, enough people do. And so we care about...
Yeah,
so what the chefs and, you know, Instagram and sort of, you know, social media influencers, we do care about what they eat. And so this structure we have where we kind of assume that there will be some foods or some ways of eating that are more fashionable or better or kind of more desirable than others. We have that structure. And so we pull things into it. And so the latest thing will go into that thing. So this, I think this is where our fashion comes, this idea of fashion comes from. We think it's natural to have something that is better than something else. And it will change fast, but it all comes from this kind of underlying idea of kind of what I eat or what these people eat is somehow better or more fashionable or more kind of, you know, classy in some way than what those people eat. And so the avocado, for example, is not, you know, I mean, I just found it absolutely mind-boggling why we could decide that this pear was the most middle-class thing ever. But we did, you know, there were all these kind of, you know, newspaper articles talking about avocado. Do you remember avocado hand?
What's that?
So avocado hand is the jab you give the palm of your hand when you've tried to get the stone out with a knife. And so the Society of Surgeons reports this new injury, and everybody says it's the most middle class injury ever, you know. And people start complaining that young people, you know, young people's expectations are so high because they want avocado toast and it's ridiculous and they should be saving for their first house and all the rest of it. And that just the idea that we've turned this sort of green vegetable into something middle class. It was quite manufactured, actually. I mean, it's the history behind it is quite interesting. It is quite and we've kind of fallen for it hook, line and sinker, because the American Avocado Growers Association deliberately kind of presented it as a sort of Mediterranean healthy, literally they use the word Mediterranean and they never use the word Mexican.
Funny that, yeah.
They kind of expunge this kind of, it's kind of, it's real history. And then they call it a sort of European, North American, healthy thing. And in America, people, you know, on the whole, people just say, well, that's something that grows on trees. But here we are delighted to find something that can be middle class. And then we put it in that box.
Yeah, back to the sneeches, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Now, I'm interested, though, but do you feel that you're immune to fashion? Do you pick up on a food and think, oh, that's cool? Or because you've researched all of these aspects, are you above all of that?
Oh, nobody could be above, you know, their whole sort of social situation, can they? And I mean, I find things out all the time. You know, people say things about their expectations of quinoa or couscous or something, you know, which I find really interesting. So no, of course I'm not above all that. I mean, I think the thing that I think about probably in common with a lot of people is how you take the focus away from class and onto good food that everybody can eat. I mean, that's the big question, isn't it? How do you kind of get rid of the ideas of class? But, you know, if they're kind of holding us back.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's talk about this, really, because I wonder if you think that the food industry, so this is a podcast aimed at the food industry, do you think the food industry is complicit in playing along with concepts of class, or has that, because of social media, has that now disintegrated and they're following trends rather than making them?
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? And to be honest with you, I don't know. I probably just don't know enough about it because I don't study marketing. I don't study advertising. I don't know that much about the contemporary food industry. I think everybody is in a spiral, and that probably includes the food industry and food retailers as well. I think, you know, it's very difficult to see in this kind of great big kind of circle that we find ourselves in what the kind of, you know, interjection points might be. You know, I mean, if you look at the kind of the way that people spend their money, for example, you know, I do think the food industry might be complicit in believing that cheaper and cheaper food is the answer to the problems of food access in this country, because that probably just isn't the case. You know, our food is still, even with our price rises, our food is still amongst the cheapest in Europe. And getting it cheaper doesn't seem to be getting rid of queues at food banks. Our accommodation is amongst the most expensive in Europe. And that's probably the structural problem, is that people just don't have enough money to spend on food after they spent it on their accommodation. But that's...
Yeah.
You know, that's partly a kind of government thing, and that's probably partly a kind of an industry thing. So is the food industry complicit? Yes, I mean, I think to a degree, the way that I understand the food industry deliberately produces food that's high in the kind of addictive, you know, salt, sugar, fats, that we want to, we kind of crave and think that that's what we want. Yes, to that degree it is, but I can also see that they believe that there's a market for them and that they've got to kind of supply. How you get around that, I don't know. I think what history can show us, I think there's probably a better question for me, is that you can change. And so there have been moments in history where people have come along and said, right, this is not acceptable. And so a couple of examples would be the gin craze in 18th century London. And whether it was as bad as everybody was making out, some historians say that, you know, it was just a bit of a kind of panic. It was still true that people were distilling gin and kind of selling it in the same day. And it was still true that people were drinking gin to their detriment. And a combination of changes in law, but also changes in grain prices, kind of changed that. And then we sort of got rid of the gin craze and got rid of decent gin distilling for a long time. But it did change. And then another very good example is the Adulteration Act. And this, I think, was the first time that doctors said, we're going to do some work on this. We're going to do some tests. We're going to look at actually what is in bread, in pickles, in, you know, what your food colouring is. And we're going to tell you. And then they did it again and again and again. And there were a series of adulteration acts in the late 19th century. And then you get food labelling and you get food standards. And so things can change. And obviously, in the Second World War, we have a crisis. And, you know, our kind of standards of nutrition were vastly equalised in the Second World War because of rationing. And it wasn't very popular with a lot of people. It was, you know, there wasn't very much variety to go around. But I think it was a lot to do with communication, not just doing it, but the kind of the way that communication was sort of just, it was a part of that whole process, on and on and on, the whole kind of dig for victory, potato peats and Ministry of Food and, you know, the home front on the kitchen and all the rest of it. And so in a crisis, I think if you get a government, if it gets people behind it and communicates well, it can make a difference.
Let's see if we can apply that to the present day. Now, we're seeing debates about extending free school meals over school holidays. We need lots of talk about food banks and you know, why do we have to have them and should they be funded or not? I mean, does food shape politics or does politics shape food in those areas?
Feeding people is just the most basic thing, isn't it? Food and accommodation has been the point of a government and law and order since the beginning of time. And so inevitably, historically, food has shaped politics enormously. Historically, what's been interesting is that what tends to happen is that you get a sort of a rather, you know, a kind of an underclass who are very unable, very disempowered, very unable to kind of put their own, you know, not well paid, not well educated, all the rest of it, not able to put their own side of the matter. And then you eventually will get a kind of concerned middle class or whatever who try and make a difference. And what has been interesting, I think, historically, is that most of those differences come not when they're saying, look, this is not fair on these poor families who are starving. It's when they say, actually, this is bad for the country.
Yeah.
If you don't feed your population well and you don't, you know, then you can't educate them well and they can't work well and you won't develop as a country. It's not good for the nation's finances. It's not good for the nation as a, you know, to be able to defend itself and all the rest of it. And so historically, I think once those arguments about the nation's health being not a matter for the individual, but a matter for the whole nation. Once people take that on board, that's when you start to see change.
Yeah, enlightened self-interest, basically.
Yeah, I think one of the problems of food banks, and this might be a shift, actually, and who knows? I mean, it would be good if it was, wasn't it? Because food banks were set up for people who were in a kind of temporary crisis, you know, who had lost their jobs, momentarily didn't have access to enough money to kind of feed themselves. And they've become, as we all know, you know, they've become sort of systemic. But there's still, I think, and I'm, you know, I'm totally prepared to be shown that I'm wrong, but I think people still feel about them that it's to do with those individuals. It's somehow to do with the individuals, and it's either their fault or we should just pity them. It's not their fault, you know, they're victims of circumstance. But I think as soon as we start understanding that food bank crisis is a national problem for us in the future, maybe that's when we'll get change. Historically, that suggests the case, but who knows? Who knows what would happen?
Yeah, well, let's hope it goes the right way. Okay, well, let's just end with one last question. And obviously, your research into food and society is complex and multifaceted, but let's boil that down to one annoying little journalistic trope by saying, if there's one aspect of food culture that you could change that might change sustainability, health and diet and welfare for the better, what do you think that might be?
It's quite small and it's also quite big. And it's the way that we should understand that the way we eat is not inevitable. So it goes back to right what we were saying at the beginning, that that we have this kind of two-tier system, and we don't seem to feel that there's, even if we think there's something wrong with that, we don't quite feel that, we just think that that's the way it is, the way it's got to be. Whereas if you look at other countries, and it's a lot to do with aspirations, so if you look at other countries, many of our European neighbours, they don't have such a two-tier system. They have a sense of kind of, this is good food, and people generally aspire to the same kind of good food, whereas we think this is good food for these people, and these people over here will never aspire to it because they have a different kind of background or something. And I think just that understanding that good food should be available to everybody. Everybody has the right to the same thing. Everybody has the right to avocado toast if they want it, or, you know, fruit and vegetables or whatever. And everybody should have the same right. And so it goes right into the kind of the problems of kind of meat and environmentalism and sustainability. If we believe that, then we might start to kind of change the kind of systemic problem of food. But it's how you do that. That's for kind of social policy people, not for historians.
you merely provide the information for everyone to act on. Okay, Penn Vogler, that was absolutely fascinating. I feel like we've only really just scratched the surface of this, so I really hope we can talk to you again.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for your great questions.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, there are hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. And remember, if you enjoyed the Food Matters Live podcast, you can subscribe on your preferred platform so you never miss an episode. And if you feel inclined, go on, leave us a review. Thank you very much for listening.